We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is now at the controls. In this part of Focus, I think we're going to have some fun talking about movies and talking very specifically about the work of one director in particular, a man named Billy Wilder, a fellow who, over a long career in Hollywood, brought American audiences over 50 films and in the process became one of the biggest personalities in American cinema. And certainly we can say that he was responsible for a list of movies that contain images that have become iconic of Hollywood's golden age. Just to mention a few, we have Double Indemnity, The Lost Weekend, Sunset Boulevard, Stalag 17, Sabrina, 7-Year Itch, Witness for the Prosecution, Some Like It Hot, The Apartment, and there certainly are others. In this part of Focus, we'll try to talk a little bit about this man and his work and his career. And our guest is Gene Phillips. He is the author of a recently published book, which is titled Some Like It Wilder, The Life and Controversial Films of Billy Wilder. That's the subtitle. It's published by the University Press of Kentucky. Gene Phillips himself has written a number of books about film. Just to mention three, Creatures of Darkness, Raymond Chandler, Detective Fiction and Film Noir, Beyond the Epic, The Life and Films of David Lean, and Godfather, The Intimate Francis Ford Coppola. So if you're interested in film and American cinema, you can go out and look for some of his books. And, of course, in this part of Focus, we'll be talking about Billy Wilder. And your questions, comments are certainly welcome. If there are particular movies that are favorites of yours that you want to talk about or that you have questions about, you can certainly call in. And one of the things about the book is that it's so much fun is that it does have information, you know, stories about what happened when these movies were produced, how they came to be, how they were cast, how the people who performed in them felt about the movies, that kind of stuff that if you're a movie fan, you certainly enjoy reading. So questions are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We also have that email possibility. So if you want to call, not call, but you would like to write in with your comments, you can do that by sending them to will-talk@illinois.edu. In any case here, questions, comments from people who are listening are certainly welcome. Well, Dr. Phillips, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, I enjoy talking about Billy Wilder.
Well, you know, I think before having sat down and looked at the book, I would have known that Billy Wilder was an important American director. But I guess I really had no appreciation for the amazing output, all of these films that would be on anybody's list of important American movies. And not only was he a director, many of these movies, these same movies that I listed, he also wrote. I think it's interesting that, in fact, in the book, one of the things that you point out is that Wilder always considered himself a writer first, even after he started directing movies. And that seems to be, when you put those two things together, that's, I think, makes his work even more remarkable.
Well, the reason he considered himself a writer, as a matter of fact, late in his life, you know, he did live well over 90, which many directors don't. In his last years, he was asked what he wanted on his tombstone, and he said, Billy Wilder, writer. And I said, don't you want Billy Wilder, director? He said, no, I am a writer who happens to direct the films he writes. And he took that very seriously, because he started out in Berlin in the 20s as a writer at UFA. Now, UFA has always been known as UFA because even the Germans can't pronounce what those three letters stand for. It's, in English, it would be the German Society of Cinema, but it's a huge, great, long three words in German. Anyhow, it's always been called UFA. And that was the biggest and really most important studio in Europe in the 20s. Because in the 20s, Berlin was really the center of filmmaking until Hitler ruined it all in the 30s. At any rate, he started out there as a writer. And he only left UFA. He was very happy at UFA, but he only left there when Hitler declared that the Jews were unemployable in 1933 when he took power. And as a matter of fact, some great directors and great writers, great composers, all sorts of people at UFA immediately packed their bags and went to Hollywood. Now, when he came to Hollywood, of course, he was just part of an exodus from Europe. And as he told me, he said, you know, back in the 20s, people like Ernst Lubitsch went to Hollywood because they were invited. People like me, and let's say Otto Preminger, were not invited. We just showed up. And he, of course, listed himself as a writer. He had never directed anything at that time. And he had spent 10 years writing films in Berlin, and he spent another 10 years writing films in Hollywood before he became a director. And the reason he became a director was that he would sneak down to the set and watch a scene from a script that he had co-written with someone. He had to have a co-writer because his English was so bad. I mean, his ideas were wonderful, but his English wasn't very good. So he had a co-writer to fix his English. At any rate, he would sneak down to the set, and he would see that the director would leave a scene out or leave some dialogue out or something. And he would get very angry because he'd say, you know, this script has been thought out very carefully, and it's like an interlocking jigsaw puzzle. If you leave out a piece, something is going to suffer later on. There's an explanation which won't be there. And so writers, you know, have always had a low standing in Hollywood. It's higher now than it was, but it's still low. And writers were not allowed on the set in those days at all. And so the first thing the director would say to him when he found Wilder hiding behind a piece of scenery, literally, he would say, you have no right to be here. And if Wilder refused to leave, he would call security and have him thrown off the set. So that happened two or three times. And finally, Wilder said, you know, I'm just not going to put up with this business of film directors vetting and rewriting and revising my scripts. And so he said the only way to be sure that the director will direct the script I wrote the way I wrote it is if I do it myself. Mm-hmm. And so he became a director for the first time in 1942. He directed the script he wrote for a film called The Major and the Minor, which is an interesting picture because it has a kind of Lolita-type story. It's about an officer in the Army who falls in love with a 12-year-old girl. And, of course, he didn't base it on Lolita because Lolita wasn't written for another 10 years. But he always said he got there before Nabokov did. And the reason his film was not censored, that he was able to get away with this business of the officer falling in love with an underage girl, is that the audience knows that she's really an adult pretending to be a 12-year-old. But see, Wilder's point was the officer doesn't know that. So he is falling in love with a 12-year-old girl, even though the audience knows it's Ginger Rogers and she's an adult. Anyhow, that was his first film, and it was an enormous success. And so he went on writing his own films and directing his own films there ever after.
Yeah. You just, I guess I find, still though, find myself wondering how it is that when Billy, when he came here to the United States, his English was a little bit shaky, how this guy got a job writing movies.
Well, I'll tell you, he said that when he came, you know, he left Berlin the day after Hitler burned down the Reichstag, which was the German parliament. And he knew that that meant that was the end of the four freedoms in Germany, because once the Reichstag was gone, the parliament was gone. Once the parliament went, Hitler was an absolute dictator. So he left overnight. I mean, he pulled out overnight. And he had not learned English. Other people going to Hollywood in earlier days, like Ernst Lubitsch, you know, prepared themselves by learning English before they went. So he suffered for about a year living in a one-room flat with Peter Lorre, who also didn't know English, and another Jewish-German expatriate. And he listened to baseball games on the radio. And that's how he learned English. But he said when he actually came to Hollywood, he knew 10 words of English, all of which were unprintable. And so your question is well taken, because he didn't make a dime that first year. He simply sat around and listened to the radio. And what's interesting is that for the rest of his career, his scripts always had baseball metaphors. He never got over the fact that he learned English listening to the radio, listening to baseball games. And so finally, he was at Paramount, and he was working with other writers, of course. Preston Sturges, who was out there in those days, he said that writers worked in teams like piano movers. And so his English was poor, but of course his ideas were fine. And he would talk to another writer in German, and the two of them would put the thing together, and then the other guy who knew English would write it down. At any rate, he was doing this for quite a while, and finally he felt that his English had improved considerably, and Paramount had the good sense to put him together with another screenwriter, instead of having different screenwriters work with him, to put him with just one, and that would become his partner. And that was Charles Brackett. And Charles Brackett was everything that Billy Wilder was not. Billy Wilder was middle-class Austrian Jew. He was actually born in Austria, although he, of course, went to the Berlin film industry. He was a middle-class Austrian Jew. He was very feisty, very outspoken. Charles Brackett was a patrician. He came from a very wealthy, very well-bred New England family. And he was the first drama critic for The New Yorker. And so Paramount said, here's a guy who has got good breeding. He knows English, English very well. And, excuse me, consequently, he can correct the mistakes that Wilder makes in English and the scripts and the grammar and whatnot. And they became a terrific team because they wrote some scripts for other directors. And then finally, as I mentioned, in 1942, they wrote the script for The Major and the Minor, and after that, they worked all the way through to 1950 when they broke up because they had so many fights over their scripts. And although Brackett was a patrician, he used to get so mad at Wilder when they didn't agree on something, he would throw a telephone book at him or a lamp. And Wilder would say, "Your aim used to be better." At any rate, they gave up working together because the thing with Wilder was, being a European, he didn't buy American censorship. The censor in Hollywood was actually an Irish Catholic from Chicago, and named Joe Breen. And Wilder was—he might have been lower-class Austrian, but he was a very sophisticated man in things like sex and whatnot. And he said, we can put things in. I put things in scripts when I was working in Berlin, and now I'm told by the censor that this is going to be censored. And so the thing is that Brackett always agreed with the censor. He'd say, "Billy, we can't have this. This is nasty. This is bad. We don't want this." He had a scene, for example, in a film he made with Marlene Dietrich. Of course, he was going to work with Marlena since they knew each other in Berlin in the 20s, called A Foreign Affair. And Wilder had written in the script that she was going to be brushing her teeth when her boyfriend came into her apartment, and that she would turn around and spit in his face. And Brackett just thought that was terrible. He said, "You can't have Marlene Dietrich spitting in some guy's face, you know." He says, "Well, Marlene Dietrich might not spit in some guy's face, but the part she's playing, she would." Mm. And so they had all these arguments, and Wilder always won. And so finally in 1950... Brackett just said, "I don't want to work with you anymore." Hmm. He said, "Your tough stuff is too trashy." And, it's a wonderful thing to note that as the years went on, American censorship caught up with Billy Wilder, because things that were considered outré in 1944, 45, or 50 became run-of-the-mill years later. So Wilder was really ahead of his time in that regard.
Yeah.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Gene Phillips, he's authored a number of books about American film and filmmakers, and his new book is Some Like It Wilder, which is about the film director Billy Wilder. His book is out now, published by the University Press of Kentucky. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. You just have gotten around to some of the things I'm interested in having you talk about, and it gets at the subtitle of the book, which is The Life and Controversial Films of. And certainly, he dealt with a lot of sensitive subjects. He dealt with, in Double Indemnity, it was all about adultery, and then he made Lost Weekend, and that was about alcoholism, and Major and the Minor is about a man who's attracted to an underage girl, and he did memorably get Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis to put on dresses. So, you know, he seemed to be pushing the envelope all the way along, and you wonder what was it that he, why was he so attracted to some of these things that at least at the time were indeed very controversial? And a lot of people would have said, you know, well, Billy, that's just not on. We just can't be putting that on the screen. You just can't do that.
Well, because as I mentioned, he started out writing scripts in Europe, in Berlin specifically, and things such as you mentioned about the transvestites in Some Like It Hot, Lemon and Curtis. See, that stuff was all taken for granted in not just German cinema, but French cinema and Italian cinema and so on. Not English cinema, but on the continent. And, you know, he was used to writing about things like that. For example, when he presented you have to give an outline to the studio before they'll green light a project. When he presented the outline for Some Like It Hot, he said, now this is based on a German film which was made in 1935. So, this was considered the idea of having these two guys dress up like girls to avoid the mobsters that are chasing them was acceptable in European cinema in 1935. I don't know why we can't do it in 1959. And so he always said he was not deliberately just trying to be controversial for the sake of being controversial. But if he came across a story that he liked and he thought it would work and he thought audiences would like, he wanted to do it. That takes us back to another film you mentioned, Double Indemnity. And some of the rules in Hollywood were just, unspoken rules, and they were just there, and you didn't break them. And he would say, well, why is that a rule? And the example I come to think of is the leads, that is, the superstar male, the superstar female, were not supposed to be evil. That is for the supporting characters. And so he said, well, if we're going to do Double Indemnity, which was a huge success, as a novelette. People think it was a novel. It wasn't. It was 500 pages. It was a huge success as a novelette by James N. Cain. He said, look, if we're going to do that, the main characters have to be played by stars, and the main characters are the baddies. You have Barbara Stanwyck getting an insurance salesman, Fred McMurray, to kill her husband so they can share the insurance policy. And it's a double indemnity policy, which means they get paid double. And I mean, the widow gets paid double if he dies in an accident. And so Wilder said, we just can't do this story any other way. It has to be this way. And they said, the people in the studio said, audiences will not accept Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray as evil people. He said, they've never played evil people. You don't know whether people will accept it or not. That was the answer he had a lot of times. He'd say, you've never tried it. You don't know. You just say it won't work. And so they said, well, audiences will not accept a sad ending, a downbeat ending. And he said, you don't make pictures with downbeat endings. You don't know if the audience will accept them or not. Well, as a matter of fact, in Double Indemnity, Ms. Stanwyck does lure Mr. McMurray into killing her husband. And then he finds out that she was not interested in sharing the money with him, but with a younger guy. So he's pretty upset about that because he killed her husband, and she all the time was thinking about taking the money and run with another guy, a younger guy. And so he just shows up at her apartment and says he's not going to stand for that. And he put himself out for her, and now she's going to dump him. And there's a wonderful scene towards the end of that film, which was unlike anything in the Hollywood commercial film before that. He says, "Did you ever love me?" And there's a close-up of Stanwyck, and she says, "No, Walter, I never loved you. I never loved any man." It's quite a statement. And she, of course, doesn't love the guy she's going to run off with either. So they shoot it out in her apartment. They have a gun battle in her apartment, and they kill each other. She dies almost instantly, and he lives long enough to turn himself in. Of course, the censorship did insist that he turn himself in. The thing is that Wilder just thought that was a great story, and of course it became one of the very first iconic film noirs. Mm-hmm. Now, as you know, the term film noir was invented by the French later, so people who were making film noirs didn't know they were making film noirs. But when the French decided what films were and were not film noirs in American cinema, that was considered one of the first and the best. And it was certainly imitated. And it's still imitated today, I think. And I had an interview with Fred McMurray for the book when he was up in years. And he said the studio didn't want him to play that part because they said it would ruin his career. And he couldn't go back and play old Mr. Nice Guy again, as he so often did in films. And he said he just thought it was worth taking the chance. And he said, as a matter of fact, it never did hurt his career because he was, you know, he made that one film where he played the guy who shot his girlfriend.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he went back to being Mr. Nice Guy and nobody minded.
Well, you know, one of the things that really strikes me is it seems to have happened often with Wilder is that somehow he had an amazing way of persuading actors to take parts that at least at first they didn't want to take.
That's so true. And to go back to McMurray again, he didn't use McMurray again until, that was 1944, he didn't use McMurray again until 1960, excuse me, when he did The Apartment. And he wanted him to play the part of a businessman who has an affair with one of the girls in the office. And as Wilder put it to me, he said, you know, this film is about the grand old American tradition of the afternoon shack-up. And he said that had not been done in American cinema before because that was an open secret. But that was something you didn't portray on the screen. And he wanted McMurray to play this really nasty boss. And as a matter of fact, when Jack Lemmon won't lend McMurray his apartment anymore, which he has done throughout the film, McMurray fires him. And, you know, not because he's incompetent in his job, but because he won't lend him his apartment. So McMurray took the part, even though by that time he was doing Disney films like The Absent-Minded Professor.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that, you know, Wilder had given him the best part he's ever had up to then, which was in Double Indemnity. He said he just thought he ought to take this part. So he did. And he did a wonderful job in the film, playing this real cad. And he called Wilder when the film was released. And he said, "I was walking down Sunset Boulevard yesterday, and a lady came up and hit me over the head with her purse. And she said, 'How dare you play that nasty cad in The Apartment?'" And Wilder said, "Well, you'll have to put up with that for a while, Fred, but that'll go away." But I think, to answer your question more directly, very simply, people knew that Wilder was a good director, a good writer, and he always took his time with actors. He had a lot of respect for actors. And they wouldn't do parts they wouldn't do for somebody else to please him.
Well, and I think that Jack and Tony, that they, even though someone came to them and said, "Look, this is a movie and here's a part for you, but you're going to spend most of the movie in drag," apparently both of them, because they wanted the opportunity to work with Billy Wilder, both of them said, "Yes,
yeah,
we'll do it."
And he told them that, you know, this is based on a proven project. I mean, this has been filmed before, granted in Europe, but it has been filmed before and came off. And he insisted that it be done in black and white. The studio wanted to do it in color, widescreen in color. And he said, well, I'll accept widescreen, but not color. Because he said, in color, the boys wearing lipstick and that, it'll look garish. It'll look cheap, you know. He says, in black and white, you'll know that they're wearing makeup, but it won't stand out and look garish. And so that was, of course, helpful to them, too, that he didn't make them look like painted whores.
Well, somehow I think the movie is interesting because while some aspects of it, like the two guys in drag, are a little edgy, that in some respects I think the movie is kind of a throwback, and it seems particularly appropriate that it be in black and white. And in fact, I think that some people looking at that movie are surprised that it was made as late as it was.
Well, the reason is, as you suggested, it really was patterned after the early gangster pictures of the early 30s. You know, gangster pictures didn't come in until after The Counting of Sound, because you couldn't really print on the screen in subtitles that gangster talk, you know, you'd have to misspell it or spell it phonetically or something. And so gangster movies didn't really catch on until sound came in. Then you had 1930, you had Little Caesar. And in 1931, you had Public Enemy. In 1932, you had Scarface. And they all had the gangsters talking like gangsters. And Wilder said that he initially had not thought of bringing that gangster angle in. And then he thought, well, we have to explain why these two heterosexual guys willingly dress up like girls. And he said, that's going to have to be a life-or-death situation. And so, of course, They happened to see, by pure chance, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. The character who is called Columbo, it's really, of course, Al Capone, the character called Columbo, happens to see them nearby and says, we got to get those guys. Well, the only way that they can escape the mob is by dressing like girls and becoming part of a girls' band. And so once he set this thing in 1929... and had the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, then he decided to really go for broke and make it a real old-fashioned gangster picture. But he said that was kind of an afterthought. It was only to provide a motive for the guys to dress up like girls. And then he started getting actors from those films back in those days, such as George Raft and Pat O'Brien. And because O'Brien was always a good cop and Raft was always a bad gangster. And so, as you indicated, the whole film took on a kind of 1930s atmosphere. And again, you said that people were surprised to know when it was made. Yeah. It doesn't look like it was made in 1939.
Right. Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Gene Phillips. He's written a number of books about American film and American filmmakers, just to mention three. Creatures of Darkness, Raymond Chandler, Detective Fiction, and Film Noir. Beyond the Epic, Life and Films of David Lean, and also Godfather, the Intimate Francis Ford Coppola, and a brand new book that is all about Billy Wilder and his films. The title is Some Like It Wilder, The Life and Controversial Films of Billy Wilder. It is published by the University Press of Kentucky and tells the stories behind some of the movies that we have been talking about. And he really had a remarkable career with films like Double Indemnity and Lost Weekend, Sunset Boulevard, Stalag 17, Sabrina, Some Like It Hot, The Apartment, Witness for the Prosecution. I sort of find myself amazed that he managed to negotiate the changes in American culture all the way from the 40s to the late 60s. And, you'd have to say that a movie like Double Indemnity it's quite a ways from Double Indemnity to The Fortune Cookie. So the sweep of the work in terms of time and what was going on in America also, I think, is pretty amazing.
Well, I think, the fact that he was a foreigner was a big help because initially when these guys came over from Europe and even the ones that knew English better than he did, there was some complaints in the studios that, not from the studio brass, but like, let's say from film gossip columnists, people like that, would say, well, we need American directors to do American subjects. And how is a foreigner going to do, a film about Los Angeles and so on? And he said, American directors can take a lot for granted about America because they were born here and they grew up here. He said, the European comes to America with a fresh eye. And Alfred Hitchcock said exactly the same thing. He said, we see Americans in America, with a fresh eye, and we can notice things that an American director would ignore or not pay attention to or whatever. And so consequently, Wilder was always, although he considered himself a very staunch American citizen, and he really did, he was always aware that America was a foreign country for him. Mm. And he would, observe people, observe things, and notice changes in some of the conventional behavior and so forth. And consequently, he would put those things in his films. Again, to go to a film like The Apartment, he could see that this kind of goings-on, which now is, of course, in Mad Men, the TV series, the same period, it's set in 1960, that people are starting to talk about some of the stuff that goes on in offices. And he said, if they start talking about it, then we can make films about it. And so on he went. Now, you mentioned The Fortune Cookie, which, of course, is about racism, and a comedy about racism. It's not a shrill kind of movie. But he made that in 1966, and, that was in the wake of a lot of the sit-ins and stuff we were having in the United States and the Black Panthers and that. Not that they were in the movie, but there was a lot of interest in equal rights and so forth. And he thought, well, he would make a movie where the really good guy would be the black man, and he would be the main character. And then, although, of course, Jack Lemmon got top billing, as did Walter Matthau, they were crooks. And they were taking advantage of him. Mm-hmm. And that was not the way it was done in American cinema before Fortune Cookie. So even with the question of race, of course, he was Jewish. He understood the question of race pretty well in his own case. He said that we're going to make the black guy the good guy, and he's going to be taken advantage of by these two white guys, and it's going to be a comedy, so people won't object.
Yeah, Wilder's first big success before he started directing, this was his first big success, and it was a movie that he co-wrote, was Ninotchka. Mm-hmm. So we're now going back some time. And if people will remember this movie, Greta Garbo plays this Soviet apparatchik who is sent to Paris to check up on three other Soviet apparatchiks who were sent there on a mission and end up being seduced by Paris and by the West and by decadent capitalism and so forth. And so she goes there to try and grab these guys and bring them back and ends up being seduced by Melvin Douglas and by Paris and by capitalist values. And I suppose that some people would say, well, there's some kind of political subtext going on there. It seems actually that Wilder himself, wasn't particularly interested in politics or at least in making political statements.
No, he certainly wasn't. And that film was directed by Ernst Lubitsch, whom I mentioned earlier. He had come over to Hollywood from Germany earlier. And while he was still in Germany, he had been the mentor of Billy Wilder. And Lubitsch was known for his films in which he pushed the envelope. Now, he wasn't pushing it in the 20s the way Wilder was pushing it in the 40s, but for the 20s, Ernst Lubitsch was pushing the envelope. And they talk about the Lubitsch touch, how he could get things by the censor that the audience would catch, but the censor would not. And so by 1939, he'd been in Hollywood for about 10 years, as had Wilder. So he enjoyed writing that script for Lubitsch. And you're perfectly right. The whole notion was not to make an anti-communist film or anything of the sort, but just to show how a Russian lady, a pretty steel lady like Ninotchka, could fall for the values of the West and what the Russians would consider the decadent values of the West. And he has one scene in there which was worthy of Lubitsch because Lubitsch told him it was. He has, it's all played with a closed door, you know, Wilder always said Lubitsch could do more with a closed door than some directors could do with an open fly. What it is, it's a suite. It's a hotel suite. And these three Russian boobs that you mentioned, who were supposed to be over here selling the jewelry of the aristocrats, are having a high, wide, handsome time in this hotel suite. So what Wilder wrote the scene and the way Lubitsch directed it, you see, first of all, these waiters going in with trays of food and drink and so forth. And then you see some waitresses going in with some trays of food and so forth. And then you see the guys come out. The waiters come out. The waitresses don't. And then you see, like, upstairs maids and people going in, whom apparently they have called, you know. Mm. And so you hear all this rollicking and stuff going on behind these closed doors. And you think you've seen a real orgy, and you haven't seen a blessed thing but a closed door. And so Mr. Lubitsch said that he was so proud that Wilder wrote that scene because he did it just right. And the audience caught on to what was happening. But the censor, of course, didn't, and so the scene went ahead.
Wilder seemed particularly to like working with certain actors. He made 7 movies with Jack Lemmon. Bill Holden was in several of his movies. Walter Matthau was in a couple of movies, but maybe that was because he was actually the first guy to put Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon together, and so they made several movies for him. Together, as you mentioned, Fred McMurray was in 2 of his movies. Marilyn Monroe was in, I think, 2 movies. What was it about some of these performers, and were there particular actors that he was really attracted to?
Well, I think, and the ones you mentioned, particularly Holden and Matthau and Jack Lemmon. He always took them seriously as actors, even though they did play comedy. And consequently, well, Holden also played serious pictures. Well, of course, the other two did too. But he thought they were mostly known for their comedies. And he felt that they deserved to be taken seriously as actors and given parts with some depth and purpose. And as a matter of fact, when Wilder put Bill Holden in Sunset Boulevard, Holden's career was down the tubes because he'd made some really silly movies, which he hadn't chosen, of course, and he wasn't getting anywhere. And Wilder walked up to him one day in a restaurant. He said, "I'd like you to play a gigolo in my next film." And he said, "What do you want me to play that for?" He said, "Well," he says, "I think you know something about being a gigolo." And Holden did, of course, from his younger days in Hollywood. And he said, "But more importantly," he said, "I think you can give a performance of depth." And again, Wilder had the male star of the film playing a pretty nasty guy because he's down on his luck, and he thinks he's going to take advantage of this wealthy dowager. As a matter of fact, the wealthy dowager takes advantage of him, but she's the female star. So again, you have the two stars being pretty nasty people. But the thing is that their performances were so toasted by the critics, and I should have mentioned that's the same thing with Double Indemnity. You know, the performances that Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray gave were simply among their best. And that is what, when you'd ask Matthau or one of these other people about Billy Wilder, they would always say, "Well, you know, I look back on my career, and the best acting jobs I ever did were in Billy Wilder's films." And I think the thing about Wilder was that he took time with actors. He didn't hurry them. And he didn't want to do a lot of talking about the method or anything, but when they were talking about the actual character in this scene, he was very much interested in hearing what they had to say. And he was even that way with Marilyn Monroe. Most directors who made one picture with her swore they'd never make another, as he did. After he made one picture with her, he said that I'll never make another one. I'm too old and too rich to put up with her, and I was a 7-year itch. But, you know, when it came to Some Like It Hot, he had the role there of this dippy blonde band vocalist, and he asked her to play it because he knew she'd be great in it, and she got very angry because she said, "I am tired of being this empty-headed blonde in movies. I don't want to play that part." And he said, "Well, Marilyn, you can give it some flash. You can give it some depth, you know. I know you're a serious actress. You've been to the Actors Studio," and she loved that because she had been to the Actors Studio. And so he said, "No, you can do this, and you can make something of it." And so she took the part, and she tested him the first day. You know, she was a tough lady. A lot of people think she was like the part she played. She wasn't. She was a tough lady. And she tested him the first day on the set of Something Like It Hot. It was the first scene of the movie, actually. That one was actually the first scene being shot first. It's in the train station. And she makes her entrance into the film by walking down the platform towards the train and getting on. And at the end of the day, she said to him, "Nobody's going to notice me. I'm just walking down getting on the train like everybody else. They'll notice the boys because they're dressed like girls." She says, "What about me?" She says, "I want you to think of something important for me to do, and we'll shoot that scene again tomorrow morning. And I want you to have me do something that's going to draw attention to Marilyn, because Marilyn is the star of this film." Well, she was right about that. She was the star of the film, and because neither of the two boys were that well known at the time. And so Wilder said, "Okay." And he wanted to prove to her that he would keep his promise, that he would take her suggestion seriously. And so the next day she showed up, and he said, "Now, when you walk past the engine, it's going to squirt steam at you, and it's going to blow your dress up." Mm-hmm. And she says, "You mean like..."
"Like the 70-year itch?"
Yeah. He says, "Yeah, something like that." And she did it. And, of course, when you see the film now, you take for granted that that was always in the film. It wasn't. It was something that she had demanded. Mm. But it really makes her entrance, you know?
Yeah, well, I think about that at that point in the film. This is early on, and Jack and Tony are still trying to get used to wearing dresses and walking in heels. And Jack particularly is having a hard time. And then Marilyn walks by, and she walks off, and they look at her her from behind walking. And Jack says something like, "Look at that. It's like Jell-O on springs."
And that, of course, was Wilder. Put that in.
He wrote so many great things. I guess I find myself also thinking about the story about when they were trying to adapt Double Indemnity, and they tried to do was just take some of James Caine's dialogue just right out of the book, and then they realized, no, people don't talk like this. You can't read this. And so what it turned out was a lot of this really snappy stuff. And, of course, you would see that in later movies. A lot of the really snappy stuff was him.
Well, that's true, because he did think that they could use the dialogue from the novel. And I got this story from James M. Cain. You know, I mean, he doesn't come off looking good in the story, so it's interesting that he told it. But he said that Wilder called him for a conference with his co-writer on that particular film was Raymond Chandler. And Chandler and... Caine were considered two of the great hard-boiled fiction writers of detective stuff, and so are crime stories. And so they had a conference, and Billy just read some of the dialogue from the novel that to Caine, and he said, "This won't play. It just won't play. People don't talk this way. It looks great on the page." And so Caine said, "Well, now I'm not writing this script. You and Raymond Chandler are. And so you guys do what you have to do." And so it's funny, forever after, people used to talk about how wonderful the Caine dialogue was in that movie. And, of course, it was written by Billy Wilder, as you said, with help from Chandler.
Yeah.
And the reason it's the best Caine movie ever done is because he didn't write the dialogue. So, and the thing is that Wilder could change, you know. That is, if he was writing dialogue for that and having the characters talk out of the side of their mouths, you know, he could write that kind of dialogue. If it was a different kind of picture, he could write a different kind of dialogue. Obviously, the characters in The Apartment, you know, are intelligent you know, upper middle class people, at least the people in the office are.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, having learned English from the bottom up, he could imitate any kind of dialect or any kind of pattern of speech and so forth, and he loved doing it.
We have about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Gene Phillips. He's the author of a new biography of the film director Billy Wilder. The title of his book is Some Like It Wilder, and it's published by the University Press of Kentucky. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email well-talk@illinois.edu. His last movie was 1981. It was also a Matthew Lemon picture, Buddy Buddy. And the last few movies that he made, just they weren't very successful. They didn't do very well. And I think he certainly felt that after he stopped directing that he still had it in him to do it, and felt aggrieved that he was passed over and overlooked and was written off. What was happening then, and did he lose touch, or did he just make a couple of bad movies? And you'd say, well, anybody could make a couple of bad movies, and should have maybe had the chance to keep going, and he could have made some more good movies?
No, I don't think so. I think he did lose touch. The last movie he made that was pretty good was The Front Page. That had been originally made by Howard Hawks as His Girl Friday in 1940. And you know, Wilder just didn't have it anymore for a story like that. Mm. And then Fedora was really a spinoff from the Sunset Boulevard, another has-been actress. And it was slow and kind of predictable, and it seemed like he had slowed down and just wouldn't admit it. Now, being a stubborn Austrian Jew, he was the last person to admit that he was losing touch. And what happened was that he kept making movies the way he'd always made them, and he went from being ahead of his time to with his time to behind time. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't understand how that could be, because he was still making movies the same way. But I think what really did him in was the last picture, because although he had always had a rather dark attitude, which was very right for film noir, a rather pessimistic view of life, it got darker and darker as years went on. And if he had a real fine property, such as Irma LaDuce or 1-2-3, that was okay, because he would leaven the darkness with humor. The problem with his last film, Buddy Buddy, is that the jokes fall flat. So what you wind up with is a very nasty story of a contract killer who gets away and, goes scot-free, lives on a tropical island, along with his punishment is supposed to be being stuck with, his Mathos, the contract killer, his punishment is supposed to be being stuck with Jack Lemmon on the tropical island. So anyhow, that story just wouldn't go. It was so dark and so nasty. It didn't have any redeeming features at all. And the reason it fell flat is because the humor wasn't there to leaven it. The jokes just fell flat, so the whole movie fell flat. And, now we judge a movie on the first weekend. Well, they were doing that back in 1981. And he knew by the first weekend that this film was dead, and he knew that his career was dead. Now, he would still say that I've got an MA to do another good film, and I don't want these Life Achievement Awards, because they indicate that I'm finished, and I mm-hmm. won't admit I'm finished. But he was. And, there's nothing shameful about admitting that a guy who started writing scripts in 1925 and directed his last film in 1981, there's nothing shameful about retiring, but he just wouldn't do it. At least he wouldn't do it unless he was forced to, which he was. So I think it's a shame that in his later years he was bitter about that, because he should have spent more time looking back at his great successes and the films that were quite well-remembered, and the films that he will always be known for. And he did make his mark on Hollywood, and consequently, I think he had a lot to be proud of. Mm-hmm. But, he said, the attitude in Hollywood is, what'd you do lately? And he said, I can't say I've done anything lately. Yeah. So it's a shame that he sort of fell into that bitter attitude in his last days, but he did.
We're almost out of time. Maybe I'll try real quick. We do have a caller here in McHenry County on line four. Go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm enjoying the show. Thank God for TCM. I am a TCM junkie, and you know now they're having the 31 days to Oscars. So we're getting treated to so many great Billy Wilder works. I mean, everything from Satellite 17 to Sunset Boulevard, all the ones that you've mentioned. But I have a couple of quick questions. How well did he get along with Preminger in Satellite 17?
Well, that's an interesting question because everybody asked he had directed directors before. DeMille in Sunset Boulevard. And the thing is that I met Arlo Preminger. I interviewed him for this book, and he reinforced the stereotype of the sort of the German martinet, you know. he was really a hard-nosed, difficult man. And Wilder didn't have a minute's trouble. First of all, they were both from Vienna. They both had come over to America as immigrants, fleeing Nazi Germany and so on, because Austria, of course, fell under the Nazis. And so he knew Preminger from way back. But he said that's not what was important about his being able to direct Preminger and Preminger take the direction. He said it was the fact that when you direct a director, the director knows that he's had trouble with actors before. And he, as an actor in your film, is not going to give you trouble. And he said that's the way Preminger was. And as a matter of fact, that's what Billy Wilder said officially. Unofficially, he said, I had to get along with Preminger because I still have relatives in Germany. And, of course, Preminger heard about that, and he was very angry because he said, I didn't deserve that job. And Wilder said, well, you know, I know you didn't, but we thought you could roll the punch.
We're going to have to stop. My apologies to the caller. I'm sure we could tell a lot more stories. We're going to have to end because we're at the end of the time. But if you'd like to read more, and there are a lot of great stories in the book, you look for it. It's titled Some Like It Wilder, The Life and Controversial Films of Billy Wilder, published by the University Press of Kentucky by our guest Gene Phillips. And Dr. Phillips, hey, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, this has been the shortest hour of my life.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.